KALW.
You're completely detached from what's going on in the world as far as like funeral services and time to mourn with loved ones. But while you're in here, you know, you don't know who to go to.
Prison conditions can make it difficult to grieve loss on the inside.
He doesn't know where I come from. He doesn't understand where I come from. So I became uncomfortable with talking to them.
How do you process loss when you're alone? Crying is not okay, and asking for help can be dangerous.
I find myself interacting with more people who are willing to show their emotions, their feelings. They're willing to cry. But I think they're teaching me something, you know, at the same time.
Grieving in Prison, a new episode from Uncuffed. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Today, we bring you the latest episode from Uncuffed. Most people in prison know that when you get an unexpected call to the counselor's office, it probably doesn't mean anything good. Often you're told that a loved one on the outside has died. And once you've gotten that terrible news, there are lots of unspoken barriers that make it difficult to mourn. On this episode of Uncuffed, the producers at San Quentin share stories of loss and all the stigmas and complications that get in the way of grieving.
This is Uncuffed. I'm Ryan Pagan here at San Quentin State Prison, and I got three wonderful older gentlemen here.
Oh my, going over to okay, age.
I was at right, their age. Older. I'm sorry, guys. Slightly. I can't help it. All right, what do you want me to do? Okay,
it's a serious piece, brother.
This is a serious piece. This is a serious story that we're going to be listening to. But before we start, I'd like to hear how y'all doing. Let's start with you, Tim.
Hey, hi, everybody. This is Tim Hicks, and I'm doing great, Ryan. You know, except for the age that you're trying to mention and put us in that box right there, I ain't feeling that, but hey, you know.
we can talk about it later after the show, all right? Go ahead.
What's up, y'all? This is Steve Brooks. Glad to be back on Uncut.
I'm Anthony Carvalho, and I will agree with that, Steve. It's great to be back on Uncuffed, and after that age discriminatory remark, I'm just wondering if I'm going to get thrown out of this room or die right here.
Look, no, that was basically some praise for y'all. You know, I respect you gentlemen. You know, you guys are wonderful mentors to me. You guys have been working down here in the media center for a while, so you know, I'm really just giving you guys some praise. All right.
Yeah.
So that's some good news, right?
Okay.
In all seriousness, guys, you know, we've been all incarcerated for a long time. And because of the many years that we've been incarcerated, you know, we've had to deal with some not so good news coming from the outside world, right? Tim, is there anything that you've experienced during your 17 years of incarceration?
Yeah, that's a heavy one right there. When I think about it, I lost a nephew, right, since I've been incarcerated. That hit me real hard, you know, like it was my brother's oldest son. And, you know, he was at a party and got into a confrontation and, you know, and just somebody shot him, you know, and out there in Oakland. So, and every week I would call my family. So I made my weekly, my call and, you know, call my pops and call my younger brother, and he the one that gave me the news. So he told me that my nephew got killed, which was my older brother's son. And so I got off the phone with my younger brother, called my older brother, and you know he started describing the incident and what happened. You know, and you know I was speechless, man. You know, my whole heart sunk. I started sweating. You know, it was just. It was horrible, man, you know, but he actually kind of calmed me down, you know, because, you know, that was like one of my favorite nephews, you know, so it was tough. It was a tough one.
How about you, Anthony?
Just a couple times, and I'm going to try not to cry, but, you know, it's tough. My wife was diagnosed with breast cancer. She had come to the last visit, which was Valentine's Day, and acted really aloof, really strange, because she was hiding something. You know your wife after 10, 12 years. And I grieved so hard that here's my wife that's been with me for this whole duration. when I was a sinner, when I was and not a good husband at all, and she's still with me, and I couldn't help, I couldn't even caress her or hold her to say it was going to be okay. It was very, very tough, very tough.
It's almost like she was trying to protect you because of this, your situation.
She actually said that, right? Yeah. She actually said that. Yeah. I go, why didn't you? I was actually upset. Why didn't you tell me? She goes, because I know you'd go crazy. And your partner knows who.
Think like our families try to do that too when they're relaying these terrible news. They're really trying to protect you and don't want you to act out in here. For me, I've had many relatives pass away since I've been incarcerated. But the one that hit me the most was when my mother died. And I remember that day going to work, and my boss comes up to me and he's like, hey, I just got a call. Your counselor wants to talk to you. And immediately right there when he told me that, my stomach sank. I knew something was wrong. And I remember when I was going, back to my building to go talk to my counselor, and all the correctional staff knew. They all looked at me. They all looked at me, and like I seen it in their eyes, right? And so I knew something was wrong. And I remember when I went to my building and I went to go see my counselor told me, and she said, oh, your mother passed away. And I really didn't know what to think. At the time, I couldn't process it, right? She's always been there for me, and just, I couldn't fathom to think about her not being there anymore. You're completely detached from what's going on in the world as far as like funeral services and time to mourn with loved ones. But while you're in here, you don't know who to go to. So we're about to listen to a story that talks about all of that. Steve, you produced that story. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
This is a story about one of our media workers, Vince O'Bannon, who had lost his son tragically. And one of his other sons just so happened to be in prison. And they were both grieving separately at different locations. And then they had this chance encounter where the son was transferred here and they were able to kind of process this pain together.
Yeah, his son was transferred here. His name is CJ. And we're about to hear from him first in this story. Let's listen.
I was in San Bruno County Jail fighting this case that I'm currently down for right now. I called my baby sister, Autumn O'Bannon. When she answered the phone, I was like, baby sis, what's happening? And she said, man, somebody just killed our little brother.
My name is Vincent O'Bannon. Been incarcerated nearly 14 years now. I was in a cell in San Quentin, and I left the cell and went and got on the phone. Called home, called my wife, and she told me that my son was gone.
My mother raised me in Bayview Hunters Point on Deadman Court. Right across from Cashmere. Catch, I grew up riding bikes with, going on bike rides and everything. Most of them all dead. Once I landed to Chuckawalla State Prison, I reached out to the mental health counselors. The first time I talked to a mental counselor, I really didn't talk to him because I had it in my mindset, this person just wanted to hear something from me so he can sit down and write it down on paper. And the last thing that I wanted was for some man, white man, to make a falsified mental assessment of my mental, emotional, and psychological being. He doesn't know where I come from. He doesn't understand where I come from. So I became uncomfortable with talking to them. And I triple CMS'd out of Ironwood. They told me there's two places I was gonna end up going. when they said San Quentin, like, Quentin, okay. I was like, man, I'm finna go see Pops. I say, hopefully they send me there. I go see Pops. And sure enough, they put me on a van. They told me I was going to San Quentin. So I'm on a van, and I'm like, I'm sweating. I'm like, ah, oh, man, this really happened. When I got off the van, it was a dude in R&R. I told him, I said, hey, man, my dad here, man. His name Vincent O'Bannon. He was like, man, I know OGV. He down in the media room. Once I got up to North Block and got settled in, I made my way down here. People was like, he worked down in the media room. I'm like, where's that at? So they pointed me there. So I came down. Before getting here, nah, I ain't want to talk to nobody about nothing. When I rounded that corner, they come here to this media room, and a dude walked in, and Pops came walking out. My whole body got hot because I felt as though, man, I'm with my dad, so I can talk about this now. I can get it off.
So I'm sitting down here in San Quentin News editing some photos, and I get a tap on my shoulder. Someone asking me to come outside. They needed to talk to me. It wouldn't take long. So I get up and go outside, and I saw CJ. But when I walked out that door and I saw him, it was just a wave of emotions, and I couldn't do nothing but embrace him.
I haven't seen him in double-digit years. So when he wrapped his arms around me, of course I wrapped my arms back around him. It was hard to let him go.
All the tears that I had been holding back for the past 2 years, they all came flooding out because this was my son too. And, you know, if I didn't have one here, I had this one.
I don't have to hold in my tears no more because I was holding them in. I'm not as angry as I was no more. Being here with my dad is a very strong healing process for me. It's a comfort zone. I think about him more now because now when I see my pop, he looks so much, little brother looks so much like him. I have no choice but to think about him.
It was a bittersweet moment. Bitter because we were both here, but sweet because we were both here.
That was Vince and his son, CJ. Such a powerful story. And, you know, even though what we just listened to was a tragedy, but there was beauty in it. And it was father and son finding each other during that tragic time.
Oh, my gosh. It showed grief is an unfinished business sometime. He was truly blessed. CJ came to San Quentin because he can close the tragedy more than we can. They knew each other. They all knew. They were blood. So there's something different about that. And, you know, thinking about closure, grief has many stages to it, which can go on for a lifetime. And we definitely saw, you know, CJ and Vince's pain.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think, you know, for those two to both find each other, it was really a blessing in disguise, but not a lot of guys are fortunate to have a close family member. And plus, we don't want to see one of our closest family members inside a prison, but they were able to grieve together. And so many of us don't know how to grieve. CJ mentioned earlier in the piece about going on Triple CMS. Now, Triple CMS is an acronym for Correctional Clinical Case Management System, and it's the primary level of outpatient clinical mental health care in CDCR. And so a lot of these guys can put in a sick call slip to talk to a mental health counselor, but like CJ said, he didn't feel comfortable talking to this person, you know, and that this person doesn't know his struggles in the neighborhood he came from. So it's kind of hard to relate to someone who really doesn't know your circumstances. You know, for some people it works, but why is it such a problem for people of color to ask for help? Because I noticed, like, amongst my people, you know, Latinos and amongst a lot of Black people, it's almost like it's a stigma to ask for help.
Yeah, it definitely is a stigma, Ryan. It's Tim here again. I was Triple CMS at a level 4 prison because up on arrival, I had lost another one of my relatives. So I needed somebody to talk to, right? So I entered into the Triple CMS program, not aware of that being a problem in the system until after. So people start coming up to me, man, why you going to Triple CMS, yeah, man? What's up with you, man? What y'all talking about? Like, I'm like, man, why you in my business? You know what I'm saying? So I'm getting offended. But I was told at that time that it's a sign of weakness. And I wind up getting out of the program because of that stigma, you know?
How about you, Steve?
So basically where I grew up, there was two types of mental health treatment. You either go to the liquor store or you kick somebody's ass. That's just two different types of mental health treatment that was available. And that was what I seen, and that is what I engaged in. You know, if I had issues, this is how I kind of dealt with it. I think that for Black people, the idea of going to a mental health specialist meant that I was actually going to the police, because it was like,
and it's the same here. Yeah, and it's the same here.
To help me with my Black problems. And that's an issue, because you don't have a lot of Black mental health specialists around the neighborhood saying, hey, let me help you with your problems. My experience with that Triple CMS program was I was always confronted with a middle-aged white man who kind of told me that, well, this is prison. You're in prison. So if you're depressed, if you're stressed out, if you have anxiety, it's just because you're in prison, you know? And so they come into a system where they encounter a white male-dominated system where you have to go talk to a white doctor about your problems, who is basically talking to you as like they're an officer, not like a clinician. And so for a lot of people, that's a turnoff, you know?
For us Latinos, like coming into prison, you're not allowed to talk to any mental health. You're not allowed to take any pills. And so for me, I didn't have no one to talk to, right, in the beginning of my incarceration. And so I had to just deal with, you know, the amount of time that I was getting, you know, people that I was losing. And I thought about hurting myself many times, right? I was always lucky to surround myself with guys that, you know, that did, like, care about, you know, me. But that was rare, right? Because in this environment, it's real toxic. Right. And you have a toxic masculinity everywhere. And, you know, and it's funny because I was thinking about when I was younger that if I cried, it was shunned. Like, you're not allowed to cry. Right. You boys don't cry. You know, so you grow up and you try to hold in all this pain and you act out in anger. And so as you mature, you know, you kind of hold to those beliefs like, men don't cry, you know, we got to hold in our mud and we got to just, you know, push on through. But at some point we break, you know, there is a breaking point.
See, Ryan, I'll tell you, my dad cried twice. And once when our dog Lady died and he had to bury Lady in the backyard, I never seen him cry. And then
I had a dog named
Gosh, when I was 50, right before I was incarcerated, his younger brother, Uncle Benji, passed away. And the whole machismo of the Carvalho family was there crying. I never saw my dad break down, cry. That was tough. But it's just part of grieving is letting go, and you let go in different ways, man.
Who taught you that crying was just a woman's thing. It wasn't necessarily a man's thing.
When I was young, you know, in my home, you know, my parents, they were always telling me, if somebody hit you, you better hit them back. You know, if you know, they taught me and my brothers and sisters how to just be tough. You know, and it although it was love in our home, it wasn't that come here, that cuddly oh my baby. You know, it wasn't none of that. You know, that's where I learned it from. Though I learned it from my home. You know, I learned it from my parents. Man, they just never they didn't give us that baby love.
Yeah, I think for me, I can relate to that. I know that when I got to a certain age, my mom was like, yeah, all your crying is just going to have to stop because I ain't going to coddle you, right? And it's almost like my mom bought into the whole machismo culture, right? Like, no, boys don't cry. Like, get up, you know, brush it off and move on.
A couple of things resonated with me is when you said how women and girls kind of buy in to the idea of men don't cry or boys don't cry. I think there was a couple of times when I was young that I had a little girl call me a punk because I was crying. I had another little girl call me a sissy because I was crying. And I think these were some very traumatic moments for me that really helped mold and shape this idea that I will not be seen crying publicly by no little girls, you know, as a boy. And that just kind of evolved into the manhood. I find myself interacting with more people who are willing to show their emotions, their feelings. They're willing to cry. And I look like the oddball in this whole thing because I don't really do it as much as they do. But I think they're teaching me something, you know, at the same time.
Yeah. And you know what? We're fortunate to be at San Quentin where they offer a variety of programs, and these programs help us to communicate. They help us to, you know, gain some insight on past traumas. And I think we have an advantage over the men out there in society because we have time to work on ourselves. And so with that comes emotional intelligence, and we are able to grieve healthy. We can cry. You know, we, and a lot of us are in the same groups. So we're all taking these groups and feel comfortable being around one another and being able to express how we feel. And so that's what sets us apart from, you know, the men out there, because we're trying to break that cycle, you know, and hopefully pass these tools that we've learned onto the next generation of young men.
That was this is the first prison I ever been at where you go through these trauma intensive groups, where you kind of just sit around and hear people crying and you kind of like feel their emotions with them. And everybody was in a circle and people were talking about their crimes, talking about some very hard stuff. And I was just like, you know, regular run of the mill group. I'm sitting there eating my ice cream because I just came from the store. And everybody, this real intense moment came, and the guy right next to me was crying, he was bawling, and everybody was just like in this moment of feeling this connection with him, you know? And I was like, I've never been through this before. Like, this is some really powerful, intense stuff. And I finished my ice cream but I understood the magnitude of what I was getting as opposed to what I got at other prisons that I was at. It was way different. But to get to that point and that level of understanding, you know, that it's important to do that, I think it took me a long time to get to that place. And looking at O'Bannon and his son, you know, this idea of them coming together and being able to have this moment where they both were crying, two grown men crying in front of everybody, that was a really powerful moment in which you saw how much healing can come from that. You know, how much pain can be processed, you know, with a few tears. So I thought it was important people hear that, you know, to give other people an opportunity, you know, to learn about what that means.
You know, guys, I'm really honored to have you guys sitting in on this episode, and I feel like we, you know, shed some light on a lot of issues that us men deal with, you know, growing up and even incarcerated too. And so I hope that, you know, because of this conversation, and whoever's listening to this can maybe gain some insight and maybe just cry once in a while, you know?
Let it out.
Let it out.
Yeah, just let it out. That's all you got to do. Let it out.
It helps with the healing. It really does.
That excerpt from the Uncuffed podcast was made by the crew at San Quentin State Prison. Timothy Hicks, Ryan Pagan, Steve Brooks, Anthony Carvalho, and Juan Haynes. Our work in prisons is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. The producers fact-check content to the best of their ability, and all content is approved by an information officer. You can hear more by subscribing to Uncuffed on your podcast player. Today's Cross Currents team includes Sandra Halliday, Alistair Boone, Devin Strolovich, Gonadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tenth, Shirin Adil, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega Welch, Angela Johnston, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.